and wonderful listening to Hank yesterday and Stephen. Just what they were saying was the perfect, I would say, introduction, but it sort of leads right into where I want to go. And also Greg as well, and all the stuff I wanted to say about God, I now don't need to say anymore. And Hank was talking about the times we're passing through, this whole spiritual, well, he was talking about it as religious, new religion that's happening. I'd actually probably, that's one point I slightly disagree with Hank, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind, is I think there's a big difference between religion and spirituality. And it's not so much that a new religion is coming, but a new spiritual awakening is happening on the planet. And it's happening with all of us. And Stephen was talking about the whole essence of that, the pure consciousness, that being universal, and just how simple it is. And that's one thing I want to be talking about today, is just how the whole thing is getting simpler and simpler and simpler. And I also find it interesting how more and more we're just all saying the same thing, which I think is actually good. I remember, I think it was one of the very early science and consciousness conferences when we were down in Albuquerque. And at the end of my talk, someone came up to me and he said, "You know, Mr. Russell," he said, "what I want to know is, what is it you're saying that's different from what everybody else is saying?" And my response was, "Nothing, I hope." Because if I am, that's where I'm wrong, out of tune. What I think is fascinating is how we're all saying the same thing, but from 1,000 different points of view. And I think what is happening at this time is this reawakening of the spirit, is we are collectively honing in on that truth. And we are all learning from each other. And so we come here on a conference like this and we listen to various speakers, go to various workshops, talk to people, take away books, we go home, we're reading stuff, we're in our local communities. We're all learning from each other the whole time. And as we're learning, we're just coming closer and closer and closer to a new collective understanding of what that essential spiritual message is. And so it was so nice just yesterday listening to Hank and Stephen, just feeling that central thrust just becoming clear, how we're just becoming closer and closer. So what I want to do really is give you my own little perspective on that single truth that we're approaching. So, I've called this talk Return of Natural Mind. And natural mind for me is a state of consciousness which is always there underneath everything we're doing or thinking. But first, let's talk a little bit about consciousness and what we mean by consciousness. Because here we are at a conference on the science of consciousness, and I suspect we probably have 300 different views of what consciousness is in the room. We use the word so much, and yet what do we actually mean by it? You know, some people say, you know, when you're awake, you're conscious. You're not conscious when you're asleep, but when you're asleep, you're dreaming. You're having experiences. It's just that you're not actually conscious of what's going on in the world around. And what's happening in your dreams is coming up from memories, whatever it is, things that are going on inside the brain, chemical stuff. When we're awake, we're dreaming the outside world. As Hank said yesterday, it's all dreaming in a way. The difference between the experience when we're asleep and the experience when we're awake is when we're asleep, it's like self-generated images and things. When we're awake, it's all coming in, or a lot of it is coming in from stimulus from the outside world. So I'm now having my own particular dream of this reality, which is conditioned by what's coming in through my eyes, my ears, my body. I am creating this dream, and because it's being created by the external world, I suspect that what I'm dreaming right now is pretty similar to what each one of you is dreaming, unless you haven't quite woken up yet, in which case You may catch up with us later. So we're conscious. In this sense, consciousness is there all the time. And that's the aspect of consciousness I'm interested in. It's getting to what Stephen was talking about yesterday, that inner wakefulness, which is an absolute prerequisite for any experience. Whatever we're experiencing, there's always that inner wakefulness, the fact that we are aware, the fact that we are conscious. And I think that's something that is not just unique to human beings. I think all creatures have that. You often hear scientists say or write, hardly a week goes by without me seeing it in some scientific journal. They say, human beings are the only conscious species. I think what they mean by that is maybe human beings are the only self-conscious species, and even that is highly, highly debatable. But I love dogs and other creatures, dolphins. But dogs, easier to get at than dolphins. I hang out with dogs, and many of us do. Others hang out with cats and horses. But when you hang out with other animals, you can't not see that they're conscious. I mean, when a dog is asleep and it's lying there and its paws are twitching and its nose is quivering, I mean, we assume it's having a dream. We assume there's some internal experience there and it's chasing some cat round the block or something in its mind. But we assume it's conscious. In fact, when somebody tells me a dog isn't conscious, my retort is, well then, if you don't believe it's conscious, why, when you operate, would you ever consider giving it an anesthetic to make it unconscious? So we clearly believe that other animals are conscious. They're just not quite conscious in the same way that we are. So the modern scientific worldview, just to touch on it very briefly, is that consciousness comes out of the brain. Now, I think there's no doubt that what goes on in our consciousness, the contents of our consciousness, the actual experiences, are conditioned by the brain, by what goes on inside the brain. But does awareness itself, that inner wakefulness, come from the brain? That's the real question, not whether our experiences are conditioned by the brain, but whether that inner wakefulness, that essence of consciousness, comes out the brain. And that is a huge problem for Western science, and I've spoken about this at other conferences here, so I won't go into it in detail now. But very briefly, the problem is, how does something like matter, we assume matter, this stuff here, is totally unconscious, and so is the matter of our brain, how does totally unconscious matter ever give rise to experience, to inner wakefulness? And this is what one philosopher calls the hard problem of consciousness. This is the real difficult problem. The easy problem is maybe understanding everything that goes on inside the brain. Even when we understand all of that and we know what happens in the brain when we fall in love or solve a mathematical problem or whatever, there's still the question of why does any of that give rise to an experience? And on the classic model, people think, well, if brains produce consciousness, then somewhere down the evolutionary line, there must be somewhere below which there's no consciousness. You have to have a certain brain or any sort of brain. Maybe, you know, do ants have consciousness? They've got a little tiny nervous system. But do you go further down? Do jellyfish have consciousness? They've got no nervous system. And one of my sort of subjective tests for consciousness is, would you find it easier to pull the plug on your computer or throw a jellyfish on the fire? Most of us, I suspect, find it easier to pull the plug on the computer, particularly when it's crashed and won't respond. We just pull the plug and reboot. But, you know, with a jellyfish, there's that intuitive feeling. There's something there. We have some innate respect. It may not be conscious in anything like the way we are. You know, it doesn't have thoughts or feelings. It doesn't really have perception of the world. But we have this sense there's something there which is intimately connected with life. And the problem with if you have a line is this thing, you have to say something magic happens, which this is quite surprising because science doesn't like anything magic at all happening. And yet, if somehow dead unconscious nerve cells in a brain suddenly give rise to inner awareness, then in some way something magic has happened because dead matter has suddenly somehow given rise to awareness. But the view that's emerging, the way that things are going, and this isn't mainstream yet, but it's what you see coming up in a lot of different areas, and again it was touched on yesterday, the whole notion of panpsychism, that everything is aware, or there is awareness in everything. And again, that doesn't mean that stones have feelings or anything like that. But what it says is we cannot completely deny consciousness anywhere. There's always that faintest glimmer, maybe nothing like we know, but consciousness has always been there. It's part of the cosmos. And so it isn't that with human beings, consciousness has suddenly miraculously come into existence. It's as life has evolved and got more complex, and nervous systems got more complex, and the sensory apparatus got more complex, so the pictures, the images, the forms that arise in consciousness, what we call the contents of consciousness, have got more and more complex and richer until now with human beings we have this wonderful 3D surround sound, touchy-feely experience of the world, complete with thoughts, feelings, intuitions, and all that stuff. We have this incredibly rich world of experience we live in. And the problem is that that's where we live most of the time. In this rich world, we get totally caught up in our experience, what's going on, the thoughts we're having, the feelings. We actually get lost in it. We get lost in the contents, what's going on in the mind, and don't notice this very subtle, silent aspect, the fact that we are awake. That's what we miss out on, because we're so caught up in all the other stuff. And I think there's this quiescent mode of consciousness, which is the natural mode. It's the unperturbed mode of consciousness. And that's where I think most creatures are most of the time. Again, if I watch a dog, you know, most of the time a dog seems quite happy and generally quite loving, probably the way most of us would like to be a lot of the time. If you give a dog nothing to do, it doesn't start yelping, yapping, I'm bored, I don't want something to do. The dog's quite happy, just lies there with its chin on the ground, sort of one eye open, checking out things, and ear perked up just in case anything interesting happens, like someone mentions walk. And then it gets a bit excited. Most of the time, it's just the state of consciousness we'd love to be in. It's just there, easy, quiet, relaxed. And now again, it gets perturbed. You know, something happens, you scold it or something, and it gets a bit upset. It loses that quiescent mode. And I think this is quite natural. When there's some danger, then that quietness disappears, consciousness becomes focused. We need to avoid this danger, do this, whatever it is. Something happens, and the animal temporarily loses that quiescent mode and moves into a more focused, active, doing, got to get this sorted out mode. And then when the danger's passed or whatever it is over, it returns back into the quiescent mode. And with dogs, I reckon most dogs, except for golden retrievers, it takes about 4 minutes to settle back down into the quiescent mode. Golden retrievers being a bit more like human beings take a bit longer. I actually know one that can hold a grievance for a whole 30 minutes. It can sit there and look at me and sort of go, not going to move. And then after about 30 minutes, it finally forgets. You know, human beings, we can go 30 years sometimes. that son of a bitch. If only that happened way, way back, you know. Other animals just let go. We are the ones that just hold on to things. So my feeling is this quiescent mode is the natural mode of consciousness. And it's there in all beings. That's where we settle to when there's no danger, nothing to take care of. But human beings were very, very seldom in that mode. Maybe for some people, they're never in that mode. We're so busy doing, worrying, planning, getting things right, that we never actually settle back down into that mode. And it's interesting, maybe human beings may be the only creature that is, their minds are active, working the whole time, not in that quiescent mode. And also, we're the only creature that's making a complete mess of the world. And maybe there's a connection there. And maybe by the end of this talk, you'll see the connection. So why aren't we in this quieter mode, the natural mind? What takes us out the whole time? One of the things is language. Now, language is a great boon. It's made us what we are. It's one of the things that's made us different from most other creatures. Not all, but most other creatures. The fact that we can communicate, and I don't just mean communicate like birds and other animals do, but we actually can share our experience. And we do that with words. I'm having a certain experience, right now I'm taking experiences, thoughts I've had, using words to share that with you, and you take that in, and that becomes part of your body of knowledge. So through language, we're building up this collective learning. Most other animals learn, but they learn primarily from their own experience. We learn from our own experience, hopefully, but we also learn from each other the whole time. And that's part of culture, having this shared belief system, shared understanding, shared knowledge is what gives rise to a culture. And it's what's behind science, all our knowledge about the world. But what language also does is we start using it internally to communicate to ourselves. We start chatting to ourselves inside. It's what's often called self-talk. And some of that's very good. You know, we can reason things out. We can plan things. Again, a great boon that's really made human beings different. The fact we can look into the future. We can look years into the future. We can work out, if I did this now, what are the consequences going to be? We don't just live in the present in terms of doing what's there. We can look far ahead. On the other hand, though, we end up thinking the whole time. When most of the time we actually don't need to think. It's a useful thing to be able to do from time to time. But we don't have an on-off switch. And if I look at myself, 95% of what goes through my head is a total waste of time. Most of it's repeats. You know, it's stuff I've gone over before and going over it again and again and again and the next day with some slight different flavor. It doesn't seem to be an off switch. In fact, it's not so much that there is an off switch. If you just leave it alone, it will settle down. And that's what many spiritual traditions have found. Most spiritual traditions have some way of switching off the discursive mind, switching off the thinking mind. And it's usually just some way of allowing it to settle back down into that quiescent state. What we do, though, as human beings, we find reasons to turn it on. Oh, I must think about that. I must remember to tell so-and-so that. And I wonder what's going to happen to the housing market tomorrow. Better look into that. And, oh, God, my relationship and the work. And where was it I ate last night? What's the name of that restaurant? And so we go on. And I find driving fascinating. You know, particularly driving down a freeway is not a time you actually need to be thinking. But it's amazing, you pass things and they trigger thoughts and the thoughts keep coming up. And that probably is not the best way to drive. You know, if you have a quiet mind, you can take in what's going on. Because the problem is, all the time we're focused on this or that, our awareness is closed down. We're not aware of what's going on. And you know this all the time, you're busy, caught up in thinking, worry. You don't notice, for example, what's happening in your body. Continual flow of information coming to you, what's happening in the body, subtler feelings, that sort of thing. We just don't notice it. And most of us probably don't even notice we're breathing as we're sitting here. You're just busy, hopefully, listening to what I'm saying. And that then triggers more thoughts inside you and something, oh, I must have meant to make a note of this, or he's wrong there. And I must point out to him afterwards why he's wrong there. And so our minds get engaged again. And we fall out of the present moment. As Eckhart Tolle so beautifully says, thinking takes us out of the present. Mostly into the future, but also into the past. And it's a fascinating thing to watch those of you who meditate. When you get really aware, you notice the seed of almost every thought that comes in meditation is when the mind slips into the future. You're there in the present, then something happens, and you start slipping into the future. And I think there's a song there for Greg. Slip, slip, slipping into the future we go. And then out of that comes, oh, I must do this, remember this, and we start thinking about the past. It was Mark Twain who said beautifully, he said, most of my life has been full of disasters, many of which never happened. We're just caught up in this thinking. So why? That's the next question. Why do we get caught up in thinking the whole time when we don't need to? And I think that comes to a second special thing about human beings is this little thing here, the thumb. Or to be more accurate, the fully opposable thumb. We can do that. We can put the thumb in opposition to each finger. A chimp can do that, but it can't rotate its thumb. And it can't do those fine manipulations. And someone once said the human hand is the most elegant manipulative organ ever evolved. And it's given us this ability to really mold things very finely. We've actually taken the earth and remolded it to our own needs, our own desires. Everything in this room has actually come from the earth. Some of the other creatures have grown for us. Most of it is things we've taken from the earth. And through our understanding, our science, our collective knowledge of how the world works, we've combined that together and produced all this stuff. And a lot of it with good intention, to make life more comfortable, to be able to do the things we want to do. And part of the problem is we don't know when to stop. So we keep on doing more and more and more. But it also leads us into what I call a manipulative mode of consciousness. We fall into thinking that if we're not at peace, if we're not happy, then we need to do something, because we've got these wonderful doing hands, and through them we develop wonderful technologies to do many other things. So when we're not at peace, we look to do something. We say the world needs changing in some way, or people need changing very often. Or we're scared that something's going to change, so we try to keep it the same. So this is the manipulative mode of consciousness we fall into. And it's a controlling mode. We're trying the whole time to control the world. And then as soon as we start thinking into the future, a lot of the thoughts that come up are sort of worries, anxieties, that say, is the world of the future, whether it's 1 minute's time or a day or a year's time, is it going to be the way I think it should be for me to be happy? And so we fall into this mode of consciousness where we're continually worrying about what might happen, whether the right thing's going to happen to us, what's going to happen to the stock market, whatever it is. And that's what keeps us trapped in thinking. And underneath that, there's some very subtle fear. Sometimes it's a very big fear. But usually, often it's just a very subtle fear, just this faint sort of worry, anxiety. And that is what keeps the thinking going on and on and on. And that's why I say most traditions have techniques of doing the opposite, of just unhooking that, so the mind begins to settle down again. But that sort of control mode of thinking is really behind most of the problems we see in the world. I mean, that's why we consume so much. You know, we consume what we need, and then we consume other things that we don't actually need at all. But there's this thought, if only I just had something more, I'd be happier. And that's why we love money. You know, we don't love money because we love little bits of filthy green paper. We love money because it gives us the ability to buy the things, the experiences, whatever it is we think is going to make us happy, the friends. It's a medium of exchange that we can get these various things we think are going to return us to a state of ease, happiness, peace. In fact, if you look at the seven deadly sins, they all come back to this. You know, lust. As a sin, it's not just sexual lust, it's also that craving for anything, ice cream, lust for ice cream, whatever it is. It's that belief system, if I just had that, I'd be okay. And it's that not letting go of that, the attachment to it. If only I could get that. Or greed, if I just had more of what I've already got, had even more money, more clothes, I'd be happier. Something I used to do in workshops was ask people to look at their closets in their mind and estimate the total value of what was hanging in their closet, and then estimate how many hours, days, weeks of work it had taken to create that, to buy that. Quite shocking for people. That thing, if only I just had a bit more, I'd be happier. It doesn't actually work. I mean, other sins like, you know, what's another one? Envy. You know, oh, they've got something I haven't got. If I had that, I'd feel better. Or the opposite, wrath, anger. You know, here's something that's standing in the way of me being happy. This person's behavior, don't like it, they're stopping me being at ease. You start rejecting them, aversion, as the Buddhists call it, pushing something away. I think it all comes back to this fact that we've got these wonderful manipulative organs, and we fall into the trap of thinking this is the way to find peace, to find happiness. And I think what happens from an evolutionary perspective, when you have language on the one hand, and a thumb on the other, I didn't mean that joke. I didn't mean it. It just came out. When you put language, sophisticated language, understanding of the world, together with the power to manipulate the world, you have a problem. Language on its own is fine. Thumbs, hands on their own is fine. Put the two together, you've got a problem. I sometimes think if there's out there, there's some ET, galactic mission control, and there's people watching planet Earth evolve and the creatures, they suddenly say, mission control, we have a problem. There's a species evolving with language and thumbs, look out. And they start saying, okay, we better watch this one closely. It's heading into the danger zone. Dolphins and whales, they don't have thumbs. They do, actually. But if you look at a skeleton of a dolphin or a whale, you see the thumbs are there in their flippers. They've got five digits safely wrapped up in blubber. They can't do anything with them, thank God. Otherwise, we'd have underwater freeways and fish farms and... who knows what's going on? Some of you know, I spend time with dolphins. I love to take people on workshops. We go out swimming with wild dolphins. And it's a profound experience for people to meet another intelligent species. Species, I like to say, of similar intelligence. I mean, there's ways in which dolphins and whales are more intelligent than us, and there may be other ways in which we're more intelligent to them. So I don't like to get into which is the more intelligent species. But let's just say they're similar intelligence. They've got larger brains than us. Dolphins have more complex cortices. The cortex of the brain is more complex. And they clearly have some quite sophisticated languages which we don't really understand at all what's happening there. And one of the things I like to do is to ask people, what is it about being with a dolphin that is so magical, transforming? Because it is, it's transforming being with these creatures. What is it about them that is so special? And the sort of answers people usually give, it's like their compassion, their non-judgment, their playfulness, the fact they just seem to be in the present moment. These sorts of characteristics. And then if you've been with dolphins, you can probably think of other characteristics. And then to say, well, okay, if a human being was like this, non-judgmental, compassionate, in the present moment, forgiving, playful, fun, what sort of human being would that be? And for most people, that's what we call an enlightened, wise, saint. Those sorts of words come up. And that's why I think the experience is so powerful. We're actually having connection with an intelligent being that's in the state that we would aspire to, that we'd love to be in. And that, I think, is what we're all aspiring to in our life, is that awakened, liberated state of mind. And we call it various names, which in some ways do it not quite an injustice, but they mislead us. I mean, the common word enlightenment, and we hear a lot, enlightenment, the word bandied around. And as soon as you use the word enlightenment, you start thinking of some wonderful state, you know, the word light. Clearly, if you're going to, enlightenment is you're going to be seeing light or something, some big transformation. He's glorified and put on this pedestal. I like to think of enlightenment, using the word light in enlightenment in a completely different sense. It's taking things lightly. Enlightenment is taking things lightly. It's not getting so wound up and so serious and frustrated or whatever it is about things. It's just taking it more easily. So we just fall back into that state of ease in the midst of what's going on. Or another word that's often used, comes out of the Buddhist tradition, is nirvana. And again, the normal, as soon as you mention nirvana, the normal response to nirvana mentally is, oh, it must be this wonderful, incredible, blissful, transcendent, out of this world state, which so otherworldly that it's going to take me lifetimes to reach it. The actual word nirvana, the root meaning, is to blow out. And it means the blowing out of the seeds of discontent. So nirvana is just returning to that state of ease, returning to natural mind. Or a word that I grew up with was cosmic consciousness. And again, cosmic consciousness, cosmic. You know, as soon as you mention the word cosmic, it's sort of big, universal, total thing. So cosmic consciousness must be somehow awareness of all that's going on, this great, all-encompassing, far-out consciousness. And I remember Maharishi, who was my teacher, Stephen mentioned him yesterday, he was my teacher for many years. He used to say, cosmic consciousness is just the natural state of consciousness. And I didn't understand it. I thought, oh, he means that this is the state, you know, whatever this big cosmic consciousness is, it's natural, this is where we all should be going, some far-out state. Rather than actually seeing, that's what he actually meant was it's just the natural state of mind. Nothing that different. And this, I think, when you look at it, is what all the great teachers are pointing to, really. And we sort of mistakenly dress it up and make it more complex. They're pointing to just this natural ease that's there. And this means it isn't about we've got to go out and find something, attain something, get somewhere. Although it's so easy to fall into that. I know I did when I started getting interested in spiritual stuff, which was back in the good old 60s. And there were some of us here, I'm sure, who were back then and how we saw it. You know, spirituality was going to be this wonderful natural acid trip where we'd be in everything, we'd be bathed in light, we'd be seeing electrons flying out of things and angels, and it'd be this totally different world. And gradually, it's fascinating what's happened over the four or so decades since then. Nearly five now. Four now. It's, as Stephen was pointing out yesterday, it's got simpler and simpler and simpler. You used to have seen that it was going to be so difficult to achieve this. And I remember reading books, and it's like you got this impression that, you know, if you were lucky, you could perhaps get there being wherever you were getting, you could get there this lifetime if you were lucky. But don't worry, because if you didn't, you could come back and make a bit more progress the next life, and a bit more progress the next life. And maybe, you know, after 10 lifetimes, we'd finally get there to this wonderful state. Instead of recognizing, hang on, it's right here, right now. If only we just let go of the stuff that's keeping us out of it. I think we've been on a parallel journey to what the Buddha was on. And some of you may know the story of the Buddha. Born rich prince, all the luxuries of his time, and realized that having all that didn't actually end suffering. And so he questioned all the classic pundits of his time, and they didn't have any answers apart from just the traditional Vedic teaching and sacrifices, do the right sacrifices, the gods will be happy. And he rejected all that. So he went off in search of, how do I end suffering? How do I get back to that state of ease? And he went off through the forest for 6 years, studying with some of the greatest teachers of the time. One of his first teachers was someone called Alara, Master Alara, who was one of the great teachers following the early Upanishadic tradition of the transcendent realms, going beyond the self, that all is Brahman. And he studied all that and meditated and had far-out experiences of unconditional space and unconditional time and moving beyond the realm of cause and effect. He lists all these. But still, he said he came back from all these wonderful meditative states, and here was the world, and he was still getting caught up in stuff. And he went off and he studied under one of the great yoga teachers of the time, Udaka, and became a very accomplished yogi, had great experiences, still didn't work. Then he became an ascetic, gave up eating almost completely until he nearly died, and then realized that didn't work either. And finally sat down under the Bodhi tree and saying, I'm not going to get up until I realize what this is all about. And that was when the simplicity struck him, that we create our suffering for ourselves, and we create it over wanting things to be different. We're not accepting the present moment, not accepting things as they are. It's just always wanting things to be different, which again comes out of this little thing that we think we can do something different, we think we can change things. And I think that's the journey we've been on collectively since the 60s. Some of you may have been on it since the 60s, others of you may have joined in later. And we went into the age of the guru in the late 60s, and I was part of that, went off to India, studied in ashrams. We had that, the age of the guru. Then we sort of moved into the age of the transformational workshop, EST. Actualizations, we could have those Western gurus, Werner Erhard, and they too fell from grace. And then we moved into sort of more, now I can do this myself, I don't need to go to these great big workshops with lots of money, I can do the self-development programs, and we started working on that, and just gradually things got simpler, and we realized that, again, we could do all these wonderful things, but we didn't actually come out fully transformed. We're still the same old us, maybe with some new understandings, new awareness. And where I see we're at today is a fascinating point. Almost the last 5 years of this collective awakening process, the leading edge has been something which often goes by the name of the non-dual. How many people have heard that phrase, the non-dual? Yeah. How many of you would say you're on some sort of non-dual path? And how many would say there's no path in the non-dual? The non-dual is, I mean, it's teachers like, I mean, in the West, there's people like Adyashanti and Tony Parsons in the UK, and in India, people like Nisargadatta represented that. Ramana Maharshi, to some extent, it's there in the Dzogchen in Buddhism. It's something which has been around a lot, and it's in Advaita in Hinduism. And I came across it, you know, back in the 60s. I started reading this stuff on the non-dual and found it both fascinating and perplexing and didn't get it. For those who haven't heard of it, there's several aspects to the non-dual. Firstly, it's the non-duality of spirit and matter, saying that ultimately spirit and matter, this polarity, it's all one. In Indian thought, they say all is Brahman. Ultimately, it's all the same. You could translate that as all is God. Purusha, Prakriti, spirit, matter is all one. Another aspect of it is there's no duality between the self and non-self. We have this image, this idea, there's a me here and there's the not me. The non-dual world says they're both the same. It's an illusion. This separation of self is an illusion. And that stuff I could understand pretty well and get it. And then there's this other bit in the non-dual which sort of says you're already enlightened, you just don't realize it. And that's the bit I used to think, so what? What help is that? And I realized it was because I still felt that enlightenment was somewhere to get to, something to attain, somewhere else other than here. When you start dropping the word enlightenment and replacing it with words like awake, it begins to make more sense. Like, we are already awake, we just are not awake to the fact we're awake. I mean, right now we are all awake, hopefully, and we are in that wakefulness. Your mind is doing whatever it's doing. And you may be having feelings and stuff. Some of you may be miles away. That's fine. The mind is doing what it's doing, and you're caught up most of the time in that, in the contents. But you could also just, whatever's going on, it's just recognizing, being awake to the fact there is that inner wakefulness there. And it's always there. And we can just begin to notice it. We can understand it. We all understand we're conscious and we're awake. But it's about, can we actually be conscious of that? Can we open up to awake to the fact we're awake? And just to notice that. And that's probably all you need to do. Remember Adyashanti, teacher out in California, who now goes actually all over the world teaching, says that if you just do that, you'll fully wake up. If all you do is just, through your life, whenever you remember, just notice the fact that you are awake. Notice the fact there is consciousness. Just keep on coming back to that. And gradually that instills itself into your awareness. So I could probably just stop there, but I won't. To give you some reasons why this is important. What the great mystics, the teachers over thousands of years in just about every culture, every tradition, what they all have discovered, and there's a real consensus here, is that when you just drop into this natural mind, the state of quiescence, which is just that, corresponds to that silent inner wakefulness, first thing you notice is that it's a state of ease. Obviously, you're no longer worrying about what's going to happen or not happen. In that state, there's no question of it being better or worse because the mind isn't engaged in, oh, it could be better or it could be worse. So there's just this state of ease, sometimes called equanimity, which can lead into more active modes such as joy, or what sometimes even talked about as bliss, ananda. The word I like to use is okayness. It's just a deep okayness. It's like deep inside there's this sense of okayness. And realizing that what we do is we disturb that okayness and make things not okay in our minds, and all that self-chatter goes on about how things are not okay. But deep inside there's that sense of deep-rooted okayness, which is what we're really after the whole time, whatever we do in life. If you look at it, if you analyze your actions, what you're doing, in the end, the final analysis, they all come back to wanting to feel better inside, wanting to feel happier, more at ease, more at peace. Basically, to feel more okay. And when you touch into this state, and I'm sure many of you have done this in meditation, when you drop into that sense of just deep ease, deep okayness, there's this awareness that that's been there all the time. You just weren't noticing it. It's like part of who we are, this deep sense of ease. And that's what we're looking for. And it's like, in that state, we feel complete, we feel fulfilled. And then we come out and something grabs us and the mind goes off and we start looking for it outside again. The second thing that I think all the great teachers point to is that when you drop into that state, you also touch into love. Not so much, you know, the love that we look for in our active lives, that sort of more romantic love, but the essence of love. I remember Muktananda, great Indian teacher, contemporary, almost contemporary, 20th century Indian teacher. One thing he said that always struck me so deeply, he said, love is the secret sensation of the self. The secret sensation of the self. It's secret in the sense that we're not normally aware of it. It's normally obscured by all the stuff that's going on in the mind, so we don't notice it. But it's there, and it's the sensation of the self. It's the feeling of the self. The self has a felt quality, and that felt quality is just love. And love, in that sense, is just a feeling in the heart. And I see that as just the essence of feeling. It's that very quiet feeling in the heart of love. And then, as the Course in Miracles says, we then disturb that and we move into fear. There's either love or fear. When we disturb it with our worry, our concern, we move out of love into fear, and then that starts controlling what we do. But deep down, this is again what all the great teachers say, is deep down, we are love. And that's something else which we are so looking for in our lives. But just as we look for conditional happiness, we look for happiness that depends upon what we have, how other people see us, what we do, all that stuff. We're looking for conditional happiness instead of unconditional happiness. We look for conditional love. You know, we find somebody who is just perfect. This is the person who's going to make us happy because they, you know, they think the right way, they have the right sense of humor, and we have this sense of connection and all these things. And it probably boils down to the fact they have all the good points of our parents without the bad points. And so here is the person who's finally going to make us feel wonderful. And we say we fall in love. I like to think of it, we fall back into love. It's suddenly, okay, things are okay. Here's somebody I feel okay with. And in this sense of okayness, we fall back into that ease and we reconnect with that essence of love in ourselves and then make the mistake of projecting it on the other person. Please don't change. Because I'll lose this sense of love. It's there inside us, but it's conditional in that sense. It's conditional upon the circumstances, the person, for us to feel it. Real unconditional love is the love that's there, independent of whatever is going on, whatever's going on in our life. It's just there. And that's always there, that unconditional love. So I think rather than seeking to find the person who's going to actually trigger that for us, and then when they change 6 months later, not trigger it anymore, we should be seeking how do we actually allow that to be there in ourselves. It's there anyway, but how do we allow it to become manifest? Which again comes back to how do we sink back into the natural mind. And the other thing that is a recurrent theme in all these teachings is when you do that, you're in touch with, they sometimes say the true self, but really the essence of self, the essence of who we are. I mean, most of us have this sense of who we are that is this unique individual self that's separate from everybody else. You know, who am I? I am this guy, male, Peter Russell, English, blah, 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 things I do, whatever. I could list a whole load of things which are labels. They're not actually who I am. And those labels can change over time, but there's all inside there's this deep sense of beingness, which isn't so much an individual sense. I mean, there's a sense that I can think back to when I was a child. I'd say when I was a child. When I was a child, I had different thoughts, ambitions, worldviews, probably feelings. So much has changed. And yet there's this thread of what we can only call presence, this sense of presence, which has been there all along. And that is, I think that is the same for each and every one of us. What I feel as my own sense of inner presence, what I label I, that feeling, that sense of presence, it's really just the feeling of consciousness. It's the feeling associated with being awake. That's what it is. And it isn't a thing. It's just this experience, this sense of inner wakefulness, which has always been there. And it isn't, as I say, it's not a thing. I think it's the same experience for all of us. But what we do is we like to turn it into a thing because we can't quite relate to something which isn't a thing. And so we make it into a thing. So we add all these labels, you know, who am I? I am this, I am that, I am, you know, some of this functional stuff. You know, what I do in the world, others, this great philosophical stuff, you know, I'm a being of light incarnate into a body. And that sort of, I'll be polite. But it's all just, we're trying to define ourselves. We don't need to define ourselves. We know that. We know it. It is the most intimate thing, which is always there. So again, this is what all the great teachings are pointing to. We don't need to do anything to find some truer cosmic self. We just need to let go and recognize what is there the whole time. And this is where the divine comes in. I think it was Thomas Merton said, when you look deeply into your own sense of individual self, there you discover the divine, unconditioned self, which he says is then, which is the very name of the Almighty. Ramana Maharshi said something similar. He said, I am, that pure I amness, that pure beingness, is the name of God. And he's not talking about, these people aren't talking about the God that Greg was singing about. Not a God that's out there, judgmental, blaming, whatever. They're talking about consciousness, that wakefulness is the divine. And that's what, when we're looking for God, what we're really looking for is our own innermost essence. And it's fascinating that all the qualities that are there, that sense of ease, the love, the self, the forgiveness, omnipresence, it's always there, it's unchanging. These are all the qualities that traditional monotheistic religion applies to some deity out there. God is love, the peace of God that passeth all understanding, the forgiveness of God, God is omnipresent, unchanging. That all applies to us, our own essence. So what I think has happened is when people have touched into this through many different reasons, spiritual practice, sometimes just grace, drop into this state and they feel these qualities. If you're in a, you know, go back 500 years, traditional Christian European culture, you naturally interpreted that as some contact with this divine being out there. But if you're in a Buddhist culture or a Taoist culture, you'd interpret that as a connection with your own innermost essence. And just to complete, I think, to say this is what is most needed in the world today. I said, what is the connection with the fact that most of the time we're not in connection with the natural mind and with a species that is doing the most damage to the planet? It's because we are caught up in all this doing, wanting, trying to make things different, trying to find ease, peace, satisfaction out there in the world, rather than listening to what all the great teachers have been telling us for thousands of years, that is causing us to make such a mess of things. And it's clear that we can't go on. I mean, I don't need to spell that out. We all read it, come across it, the dangers facing us. And it's also clear that we need, now is the time we need to start making, not start making, but to be making that transformation in ourselves more and more rapidly. And the good news is, as I started off saying, it's getting simpler and simpler and simpler. It's just realizing it's not about trying to get anywhere. All these complex teachings, we don't have to follow all these things. It's more how do we connect back into the essence? And what I've been exploring the last few years and something I want to follow up in the workshop this afternoon is how can we do this, not only making it simpler, but the simpler it gets, the easier it gets, and the faster we can do it. I don't believe we have to practice this practice for 2 years, and then you can have this advanced technique, and then do this practice, and gradually you progress. I think we're fine-tuning it now, whereby we can understand how to let the mind drop into this almost instantly, on demand. And that, I think, is the important thing. It's what I call the accelerated program. We haven't got time now to wait for years and years till we all get enlightened. We need to be waking up continuously every day, again and again and again, and encouraging others to do it, helping others to do it. So I think, was it either Stephen or Hank? Yes, I think it was Stephen saying, I forget which one anyway, but the real teacher is inside us, the inner guru. And again, I've heard many people say that and we give it lip service. But I really believe that's true. The teacher we're all looking for is our own inner wisdom. It's there. And something else I've been exploring and want to share with you later is how do we get in touch with that? If that is true, we know everything we need to know, really. How do we allow that into our awareness? And how specifically can we allow our own inner teacher to be our meditation guide? So that when we're in meditation, our own inner teacher can actually guide us. We don't have to sit down with somebody else to guide us, some other wise meditation teacher. We can actually use our own inner teacher to guide us. And that's something else I want to share with you, some of the ways I found to actually do that, which again accelerates the whole process. And I thought to finish, I'd like to just read you a very short poem, which used to be really important to me years ago, and I just rediscovered it. And it's called the Chaldean Oracle. Chaldea was a civilization back in 500 years BC. And at that time of what's often called the Axial Period, when so many great teachers were appearing, the rise of Greece, Pythagoras, Buddha, Confucius, all these people arose at the same time. And this poem comes from that time. But don't ask me for the source, because I've tried to track it down and I cannot find it anywhere. But I have the poem. And I'm over 40. Yes, there is that which is the end of understanding. Yes, there is that which you will only understand at the mind's flowering time, when she shall leaf and bud and burst into her fullest inflorescence of fine flowers. But should you try to trammel up the mind and bind her, confine her, and strive to turn her inwards, you will not understand. For there is a power of the mind's prime, which rising like the sun in all his majesty, shines forth with rays of thought at one with feeling. Hold still the vision of thy soul in purity. Freed from all else, let but thy little mind be empty of all things else, all things save one, thine aim to reach the end of understanding, for that subsists beyond the mind.